Greetings and salutations, welcome back to Colin's Last Stand right here on YouTube. My name is Colin Moriarty. I appreciate your time and I appreciate you being here with me today. Now, as I promised, we're going to do a history video today because I know the last two videos have been kind of contemporary and based on social things that have been going on with the Wonder Woman Alamo Drafthouse fiasco and then with Kathy Griffin and Bill Maher. So I want to jump back into history. This is an episode I've been wanting to do since I started the show and I'm finally able to do it. What I want to do today is talk about that one moment in time in the year 1814 when the unimaginable happened here in the United States, in the very young United States at the time. This was when the British walked into Washington, D.C. and burned it to the ground. It's a great story. It's an interesting story. It's encapsulated within the greater story of the War of 1812, which I'm only going to get into very briefly here. But what I really want to do is tell a few stories and a few anecdotes that are just fun to think over and mull over and kind of put yourself in that position at that time to think about kind of some of the amazing things that happened during this unlikely event. So if we go back to the year 1814, the United States is young. The United States is very young. It's a few decades old. And we're only in our fourth administration, our fourth presidential administration. The fourth president was a man named James Madison. James Madison is a very important figure in American history, one of the most important figures in American history, indeed. Really the author and the father of the United States Constitution, who later served in some cabinet roles in places like Jefferson's cabinet, and then became president himself. James Madison was a meek and meager man. He wasn't a physically imposing man. He didn't have a physical presence. He was an incredibly smart man, a brainiac, according to pretty much all of his contemporaries. And as the father of the Constitution, that's not a huge surprise. But it's ironic that George Washington managed to avoid war. John Adams almost went to war with the French when he was president, but that was staved off at the last second. Thomas Jefferson almost went to war with the British in like 1807, 1808, but staved that off as well. And here is James Madison, who has to really deal with a really huge problem. What is the problem? Well, it's a multi-tiered problem that ultimately catapults us into war with the greatest empire on the planet. Even then, we had already fought them and beaten them a few decades ago, and we wanted a piece of them again. But unlike the American Revolution, this time didn't go very well. The War of 1812 is a complicated thing to understand, which is again why I don't want to spend too much time on it, because it's not super relevant to this video, but some dressing, as it were, is necessary before we get into the actual meat of the story. A little bit of an appetizer. The United States was this nascent country, this republic, that didn't have a lot of push or pull in the world yet, especially with the European powers in Western Europe that it was dealing with in terms of trade and all of this kind of stuff. The British and the French were always and forever at each other's throats. And as you'll remember, because we talked about it in previous videos, the American Revolution really centered on that as well, about the struggle and the tension between the British and the French. The French got involved in the revolution on our side simply to stick it to the British, and they are still fighting. Except the British don't find themselves in the Seven Years' War or anything related to that like they did in the French and Indian War time leading up to the Revolution. They find themselves in the Napoleonic Wars with a very, very serious threat in Napoleon Bonaparte. France over the last couple of decades has really fallen apart and fractured. The French Revolution happened. Napoleon comes in. It's a very complex and complicated affair. This tension between powers in Europe got America involved with their sailors and their ships and their ability to trade. The British didn't want the Americans trading with the French. The French didn't want the Americans trading with the British. But really, this came down to the way the British were treating us on the high seas. The British were seizing our vessels. The British were doing what was called impressing our sailors, which doesn't mean that they're impressing them, like, wow, I'm very impressed. It means that they're taking them and making them serve on British ships. And also, America's honor's at stake because America's getting pushed around a great deal. Now, there's even more to it than this. Thomas Jefferson passed something called the Embargo Act in 1807 that was supposed to try to deal with this. It backfired on America and American industry and really hurt American merchants and American sailors and American business interests. At the same time, the British were also at least casually dealing with Indian tribes. You might have heard of Tecumseh, for instance, that were dealing some blows to the American Republic in some Indian skirmishes. So the War of 1812 is really this complex and complicated geopolitical ordeal from the early 19th century, and it leads to war in June of 1812 when the American Congress, at the behest of James Madison, declares war on Great Britain, which was, at the time, and still today in thinking back on it, totally unthinkable. What we need to know about the War of 1812 from here is that the United States invades Canada. Canada at the time was not the independent country as we know it today, but were British colonies. And the United States was interested in grabbing territory up there in Canada, invading Canada for land grabs, but were also having a scorched earth kind of mentality up there as well, and burned down many buildings and many towns, including the Parliament of Lower Canada in what was known then as York, Canada, which is now Toronto. This didn't sit too well with the British, and they wanted to retaliate. And so they did. And they retaliated in the worst possible way for American pride and prestige and for the war effort itself. They march on Washington, D.C. Now, today we picture Washington, D.C. as this bustling metropolitan city. But we have to remember that Washington, D.C. is really this upstart city that's only 15 years old or so at the time that the War of 1812 breaks out. It's a city, they called it the Federal City or Federal City, Washington City, all these different names. It was the idea that they were going to build a prestigious capital that wasn't existing in any of the existing states or colonies at the time to kind of balance out the powers between these states that had this loose alliance with each other but didn't really quite trust each other. So Washington, D.C. is not what you're picturing today. It's still compared to Philadelphia and Boston and New York and Baltimore and Charleston and some other places in the United States at the time in 1814, still a very nascent, young, and small place. When the British walked in to Washington, D.C. in 1814, in the summer of 1814, they found it virtually abandoned. The Americans assumed that if they took Washington, that it would be a symbolic victory, but not really anything very important for them. They were more worried about places like Baltimore and Philadelphia. So they didn't leave Washington, D.C. well defended. And that ended up being a massive strategic error on the part of the Americans. In an attempt to embarrass the Americans to the utmost degree and to retaliate for what happened up in Toronto, or what would become Toronto, the British ordered the city burned to the ground. Now, there's some controversy on whether this is actually true or not, by the way. Some people say that it wasn't for retaliation. Others say that blaming what happened in Canada by the American troops earlier in the war only happened after the fact, when the British started getting some heat, even from their own people, for ransacking, for basically sacking a capital city, which didn't happen very often in warfare in the 19th century. At least dignified, gentlemanly warfare the way Europeans fought it at the time. Nonetheless, this is where the interesting stories begin, because there are a few stories that are fascinating that's going on in this very brief period. It's important to note that the British are only in Washington, D.C. for about 24 hours. They abandon the city after they destroy it. And it's the only time the American capital has ever fallen. Indeed, it's the only time the American capital has ever been occupied, that a foreign soldier has ever stepped foot in the capital city of the United States. One interesting character in this is Rear Admiral George Cockburn, who is from the British Navy and is one of the leaders of this movement into Washington, D.C. Their only target isn't the White House. They also want to burn down other buildings. They want to burn down Congress, and they want to burn down the Library of Congress, and they want to burn down a few other government buildings in addition to the White House, which, by the way, wasn't really referred to the White House at the time. It was referred to as the Executive Mansion or the Mansion. It was called the White House a little bit later. Picture this in your head. George Cockburn walks into the House of Representatives. The House has been completely abandoned. All the congressmen have left. The congressman's aides and workers are gone. The building's abandoned. Cockburn walks into the chamber accompanied by a ton of redcoats. Cockburn sits in the chair of the Speaker of the House. He's noted as screaming out from the pulpit to his men, "Shall this harbor of Yankee democracy be burned?" To which his men apparently scream in the affirmative. And they're doing this as they're stealing and ransacking all sorts of shit from the Congress, from the House of Representatives, and later the Senate. They take all of their goods, anything that's really not nailed down that's valuable, and they scorch the place. The Library of Congress is also burned down. And this is a great traumatic episode for American scholarship, because at this time, there are several thousand books, a bunch of collections of papers, and a lot of things from the founders and the founders' generation that were lost forever. But lucky enough, Secretary of State at the time, James Monroe, who becomes president after James Madison's second term, this is an unbelievable story, is on horseback spying on British columns before they enter Washington, D.C. So let me reiterate that. The Secretary of State of the United States isn't behind a bunch of soldiers, isn't far away from the scene. He's still in the outskirts of Washington, D.C. on a horse, spying through a looking glass on the British, sending notes back to his men in Washington, D.C. as they're scrambling to get the hell out of there. And he tells them to save as much as they can. And what do they save? They save the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, a bunch of papers, including George Washington's personal papers and personal letters, and a bunch of other things that they can carry. But unfortunately, they're not able to save everything else, and the British roll in. But this is when the most famous story of the burning of Washington, D.C. happens, which is the burning down of the White House, the Executive Mansion, and what happens therein. A couple of days or so before the British take Washington, D.C. and burn it to the ground, James Madison, president, leaves to go and meet with some generals and some soldiers back on the front. So he's nearby, but not in the capital city. He tries to get his wife, Dolly Madison, who's really one of the most beloved of all first ladies in American history, to go with him, but she doesn't want to. James Madison leaves behind a coalition of about 100 soldiers to protect her and to protect the executive mansion. It's not going to be enough to hold anyone off, but it gives him a level of safety, and it gives her a level of safety. Meanwhile, she, like James Monroe before her, is on the roof of the White House or on some second-story windows in some high places using a spyglass of her own to try to see where the British are and where they're going and what they're doing. It's important to note that this would never happen today. Not only with James Monroe, but also with James Madison and with Dolly Madison, they're all within proximity of the British Empire. And it's really safe to assume that James Madison, in terms of proximity, was the closest an American president ever got to being outright arrested or killed by an enemy force. You could make the argument that George Washington, when he rode to snuff out the Whiskey Rebellion as president, was one of those men, but no one was going to shoot on George Washington, especially his own men, especially men that he served with during the Revolution. So this was really a precarious situation that James Madison, and especially Dolly Madison, found herself in. As the British soldiers entered the city, she saw from afar that she didn't have much time. And she tried to scramble to save a bunch of paper. She actually writes a letter during this time that she gets out to a friend of hers that explains exactly what's going on. It's a great primary source to, like, the moment right before the White House is burned down. And she's trying to protect her papers, her jewelry. She has her slaves and her servants running around trying to grab things. And there's one thing in particular that she wants. It's a Gilbert Stuart painting, the famous Gilbert Stuart painting of George Washington. Now, there is some controversy on whether this is the original Gilbert Stuart or a copy of the original Gilbert Stuart painting. But either way, it's likely that he painted it. He even painted copies of his own painting. So this was it. And this was symbolic to the founding generation. Remember that James Madison and Dolly Madison knew George Washington. This wasn't just a person from the past for them. They knew him, they served with him, and he was a hero to all Americans. With the exception of Lincoln and FDR, no American was as revered or anywhere near as revered as George Washington. So her servants start messing around with the painting, the frame, trying to unbolt it. It's this huge thing on the wall. Eventually, she tells one of her men to take a knife and cut it out of the frame, and they run out with it. And it's important to note today that in the White House, there are only two items that are from the original White House, the original pre-1814 White House before it was rebuilt. The first being this small table that was stolen by a soldier and then actually returned by the grandson of the soldier to FDR in the 1930s. Pretty interesting. And also the painting itself, which is in another frame back in the White House. As Dolly Madison and the last of her people, her servants and soldiers and her protectors, are running basically out the back door of the White House and getting away, the soldiers are basically coming in the front door. And what do they find when they walk in? They find something incredibly opulent. Similar to stories told at the Congress before they burned it down, the soldiers and officers in the British Army were surprised by how well the Americans were living. Because we had this great bravado of, we don't have a king, we don't have a monarchy, we don't have these state jewels, we don't have anything. But what they found were buildings far in excess of what they expected to find in the American capital. Dolly Madison and the whole fray was actually expecting a few dozen visitors to the White House that night. So the tables were set. And Dolly Madison, unlike her predecessors, Thomas Jefferson was a widower. John Adams's wife, Abigail Adams, was a more simple woman. And George Washington never lived in the White House. So she was really the first lady to make it what we kind of see the White House as today, which is this beautiful, stately mansion. And the British walk into that, but they also walk into a massive set table. And they walk into beautifully set food, cooked food. Food that these men, these enlisted men, would die for, including fine wines and all this stuff. So what do? They eat and they drink. It's at this time that there's some interesting anecdotes and stories told about what the soldiers were doing there at the time. One man was said to have stabbed his bayonet through James Madison's hat, his tricorner hat that was left there near the table, and lifted it into the air. And they made fun of it and said the hat of the little president, again, making fun of Madison's short stature. Another soldier was said to have gone through James Madison's clothing, even taking some of his shirts, trying on his shirts, and taking his sword as his own. And they continued to ransack the building. Now, it is important to note something else. Americans were also, unfortunately, getting in on the ransacking. Not only in the White House, but in other parts of the abandoned Capitol. This house that Dolly Madison had tried to build up with her husband to welcome all sorts of different scholars and people and politicians and have a sort of Western European air and elegance to it was suddenly finding itself in flames, and the White House was completely destroyed. The shell of it existed afterwards, and actually, if you look at the White House today in certain parts of it, certain unpainted parts of the outside of the main building, you can still see the burn marks that the British left behind today, which is one of the most interesting pieces of history of the White House, if you want to take a look at some pictures or see them when you go yourself. And in all of this retaliation for what apparently happened in Toronto and the British kind of trying to meet fire with fire, things are stolen, some are kept and some are returned. When the Americans went up to Canada, they stole things like a golden staff that was used in parliamentary proceedings in the colonies, in the British colonies, as well as this lion statue that's actually still in the U.S. Naval Academy to this day. It looks like it has a few extra chromosomes, if I do say so myself. Interestingly, FDR swapped the mace, the staff, back to the British in the 1930s, I believe, in exchange for a stolen book of James Madison's, because one of the things that the British stole out of the White House before they burned it down was James Madison's receipt book for federal outlays, apparently. And that was returned, a trade that happened more than 100 years later. For their part, when the British were ransacking through Washington, they stole things like portraits of King George III and Queen Charlotte that were still in the American territories that actually hang in Bermuda's parliamentary building still to this day. They also stole things like a grandfather clock and basically anything else that they can carry. One man or multiple men can carry, get on ships, and get out of there. And it would be really interesting to know what artifacts are still in private hands, handed down through the generations, that were stolen from Washington, D.C. A series of interesting or ironic events happened in the weeks after the sacking of Washington, D.C., however. The first thing is the battle at Fort McHenry, which happens weeks later, which is really a draw, but that's when the Star Spangled Banner is written, the bombs bursting in air and all that kind of stuff. That's from the War of 1812, and that's from that specific battle that happened weeks after Washington, D.C. fell. More interestingly, though, was the day after the burning, which is when a rainstorm came through Washington, D.C., covered Washington in rain, and put out all the fires that had been burning for the better part of a day. And this was especially poignant because in the weeks leading up to the sacking of Washington, it hadn't rained at all. It was a very dry summer indeed. Some argue that the rain actually made the destruction worse, that there was even a tornado that touched down in Washington, D.C. The winds were extremely harsh and hazardous. Trees were falling, but it did put the fires out. And a lot of people looked at it as kind of like manna from heaven, that the rains came and helped put out the fires at America's darkest moment at that time. And of course, the war would end just a few months later when the Treaty of Ghent is signed between the British and the Americans in basically a stalemate. No one really wins the War of 1812, although it's easy to see how the Americans probably lost in the main, but that wasn't really signed, sealed, and delivered, as it were, in the Treaty of Ghent. And America's very own favorite psychopath, that fucking psychopath himself that I love so very dearly, Andrew Jackson, was in on the final battle of the War of 1812, which was a complete rout of the British, in which the British lost 100 men for every one American killed. This made Andrew Jackson into a war hero, and it actually happened after the treaty had already been signed, but no one knew any better. We've since, of course, become very good friends with the British again, and we have what's called a special relationship with them, which is something I take very seriously, and I know a lot of my British friends out there take very seriously as well, because we've always had each other's backs since that moment in time. But it's funny and interesting that the darkest moment in American history, from a domestic standpoint, from something terrible happening to us, from us literally losing our capital city for a time, happened because of a conflict with the British. Some even called it the Second War for Independence. This was a very loaded war indeed, something that was fought to reassert American pride and American honor, and something fought in some ways by the children of the revolutionaries. So they had a chip on their shoulder and something to prove as well. And again, from what I told you in the beginning with the impressment of sailors and the infringement on trade rights and all of this, the Americans had a case building for many years against the British, and they finally went to war. And it didn't turn out the way anyone had planned. As you can see in the sign back there, if you've noticed, the Americans expected not only a quick and swift victory over the British, who were at the time, at the beginning of the war, distracted by Napoleon, but that they expected that we might actually take Canada for our own. Of course, instead of expanding north, we end up expanding west all the way to the Pacific. It works out well for us, and we have good friends up there in Canada today too. So I hope you enjoyed that little journey down the historical rabbit hole with me. I had a lot of fun with it. I hope you did too. It's interesting to put our minds into this space and to think about what's going on, because again, history isn't only about dates and times. It's about great stories. And it's a great story to hear about the general sitting on the seat of the House Speaker, yelling at his men and making fun of American democracy as they ransack it. It's interesting thinking about a British soldier trying on James Madison's clothes. It's interesting thinking about Secretary of State James Monroe spying on British columns and sending letters through scouts back to his men to get precious documents out of Washington, D.C., anticipating that the British were about to seize it. It's interesting thinking about Dolly Madison ordering her slaves to take a painting that is so important to her and get the hell out of there. It's interesting that FDR made some swaps with people in the 1930s to get some of those artifacts that were lost back. And of course, it's interesting to know that our capital city was burned to the ground, an epic rainstorm put the fires out, and we were able to pretty quickly rebuild it. I think the capital was rebuilt in some respect in totality by 1818 under James Monroe. Interesting aside, the city was almost moved to another place because it was so expensive to rebuild Washington, D.C., but they resisted that urge and stuck with Washington, D.C. So it wasn't only this capital city that was overgrown today. It still exists today, and it is a massive metropolitan city and the prideful capital of the United States of America. As always, I'm curious what you think of this episode, so let me know in the comments. Keep it respectful to me and to others. It's always appreciated. I think we're building a very special community here for Colin's Last Stand, indeed, and I know a lot of you agree. Of course, you can thumb up the video if you like it and thumb it down if you don't, and support me on Patreon if you can, although you don't have to. This is completely fan-funded. You'll notice no baked-in ads, no advertisements, all funded by very generous people over at patreon.com/Colin's Last Stand. $1, $5, $10 a month really goes a long way, and I very much appreciate you for doing that. You can, of course, find thriving Colin's Last Stand communities at places like Reddit and Facebook. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm all over the place, so find me online. I'll talk to you guys soon. Let me know what you think. I enjoyed this episode. I hope you found it interesting. History fucking rules. I'll see you next time. Keep on learning.